So yeah, I am not convinced by the in our show notes, right? Jono's written apparently Revolutionary Health Smartwatch and a bunch of description, and then just written looks fishy to me, which sounds like a very good description of it, in my opinion.
Listeners, and welcome to episode 41, season 2 of Bad Voltage, released one day late. Today, if Baconio is correct, is yes. Friday, November 2nd.
Yes.
So this is a good way to kick off your weekend.
Oh, it's the only way to kick off your weekend. Something for the weekend, sir.
Yeah. So what are we going to talk about today?
We're going to do news for a whole show because we love doing the news. And frankly, we are a little bit lazy. I couldn't think of anything else to talk about. So,
but it's more that we have loads of stuff to talk about, to be honest with you. Quite a lot has happened.
That's right. That's right.
A lot has happened indeed. And on that fine note. Oh, no, you can. Go ahead.
Do you mind if I start? Well, IBM has acquired Red Hat.
And now Bad Voltage.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That too.
They have. For the three people left who haven't heard.
Yes.
I was going to say, did this happen? Oh, my goodness. When did this happen?
So apparently they've been acquired. The value of the deal is $34 billion, which is a lot of dollars.
A lot of dollars.
Apparently, prior to this, Red Hat's market capitalization was at about $20.5 billion. So there's been quite a lot of discussion about why IBM have got into this and why IBM are doing this.
Yeah, why they're paying $190 a share for a thing where they could have got it for $120 or whatever it is.
That's so, not how that works, but okay. No.
Well, yeah. You know what I mean.
It was a 60% premium over their closing price the day before they announced this.
So, I mean, my theory here is, it's not much of a theory. I think it's pretty obvious, but this is all about IBM growing into the cloud, and Red Hat have done some pretty amazing stuff, particularly in the hybrid cloud side of things. What's your theory about why this has happened?
So I have so many thoughts here. I really don't even know where to start. There's I think one thing that's interesting before we get off the valuation side of this is that as of today, the price of RHT is only $171. So a $20 differential on people speculating that the deal won't close, which is a fairly substantial arbitrage there. So definitely some people don't think this is going to close for whatever reason they don't think it is. So I think that in itself is a little bit interesting.
Right.
To the reasons, I mean, there are a ton of reasons. I think it's pretty clear that IBM's strategy of just laying people off through attrition or not letting them work remote, turns out that's not a great strategy for long-term growth. I think that the billions and billions of dollars that Microsoft and Google and Amazon are spending on the cloud has now dictated that it's almost impossible to catch up, even for someone with the pockets of IBM. So I think this is a play to try to ameliorate the concerns of the last 10 years of not investing. I think you look at... while they did have one quarter of growth this year, they had 22 straight quarters of decline, which is pretty staggering when you think
IBM?
About it. Yeah. And if you look at where their growth is, it's even more astonishing. Their mainframe business up 2%. Their traditional services, non-technical services business up 3%. Technology and cloud are flat. Cognitive solutions is what they call Watson, down 5%. So the thing they advertise the most, doing the worst. So I think that they're struggling. I also see this as kind of a next Apple play where I imagine they're hoping that the culture from Red Hat subsumes the culture of IBM. IBM is a massive, massive ship to turn, though. I suspect this either goes very poorly or by June of 2019, Jim Whitehurst is the CEO of IBM.
Yeah, I mean, on the financial side of things, what's interesting as well is that if I'm correct, I haven't looked at the data recently, but IBM, Red Hat has had like 60 straight quarters of growth, right? Yeah. So, which is quite a contrast to IBM. And my theory as well was also along those lines. I mean, I would foresee that Jim Whitehurst is going to be CEO of IBM at some point in the future. He's a profoundly capable CEO in what he's done both at Delta and at Red Hat. The question in my mind is going to be whether he'd want to be CEO of IBM, and I suspect that he will. I suspect that he will be thinking in round numbers. That he will be. He will put a timeline on it, maybe until 2025, something like that.
Well, but there is an age thing here, right? IBM tend to like CEOs to leave when they're 60. Rometty is already older than that, as I understand it. I think she's 61. Jim is, what, about 53, 54?
Early 50s, which is when they like to hire their CEO. So it's fits
absolutely.
Right in.
So I think his, you know, putting a timeline on it will be, do it until I'm 60, much as other IBM CEOs do. So you get a sort of a seven-year period, just like all the previous people have.
Right, right. No, the it lines up very well.
Yeah. I think it's interesting, Jeremy, you mentioned culture there. I mean, obviously, there are a whole bunch of actual real bottom-line hard-nosed business reasons why they're going to do this. You don't go and spend $34 billion just for cultural change, even though maybe you should.
You don't.
But I think it's not just internal culture. I think part of the reason that IBM are declining is because people don't want to go to them for stuff. Because they're old hat. You know, Microsoft buying GitHub is partially for a whole bunch of actual business reasons, and partially so they can turn in things, partially so they can unify it with Azure and all that. But some of it is attempting to appear slightly like the new cool people, because then you build mindshare again. Right? You've got to build mindshare in the next generation. People who are currently 18 and 20 and in 10 years will be 30 and middle managers, and 10 years after that will be 40 and at high level and controlling purchasing decisions. You've got to be relevant to people like that. And that's some of what I think is behind things like the Microsoft GitHub acquisition, and it's partially behind this, that they... If I said to you IBM, nobody thinks of all this magic cognitive services Watson rubbish. They think of mainframes in cellars in the 70s.
I don't agree with you.
I think the shift is a little bit more profound than that. I think when Gerstner shifted to IBM, what they really sold was the integration of a lot of complex pieces during a sea change time in technology, right? The internet was new. People were moving from things like mainframes to things that were very different than mainframes. IT departments had very old procurement policies, and there was very few super large companies that people, you know, CTOs trusted to do from top to bottom everything, right? And that's where IBM, that's really what IBM sold was, as they said, one throat to choke. I think as we shift to the cloud now, and things are quote unquote good enough, if you believe in like the Clayton Christensen model, I think that really hurt IBM more than they realized. They thought the cloud would never be adopted by enterprises, and lo and behold, here we are. And the oldest of enterprises and the stodgiest of things, banks and the like, are all moving to public hybrid cloud. So I think they really didn't see the change. Much like Microsoft for a while didn't see the change. Microsoft saw it earlier here than IBM. But I think it's partially mindshare, like you say, but partially a profound change in how computing works at the enterprise.
The thing is as well with comparing Microsoft and GitHub, like in my mind, there's no doubt that the Microsoft GitHub thing is because the GitHub generation of kind of modern JavaScript web developers who are working in startups and elsewhere is a very different audience to the Microsoft audience in many ways, and that there's a very clear reason for them to acquire GitHub, because first of all, it's an audience that they want to attract, and secondly, there's a very direct correlation to Azure, which is like their major area of focus and arguably the future of Microsoft. To me, with IBM and Red Hat, it's a little bit different in the fact that, yes, IBM are a big old stodgy company, but I think the kind of people who are buying Red Hat Enterprise Linux don't necessarily see IBM as stodgy as we might. The difference is, I think, is Red Hat are basically today's IBM, right? They are the major enterprise cloud vendor, I think, for a lot of businesses. And IBM, I think, is kind of rotting from the inside out. And I think they will see Red Hat as, first of all, they can become like the ultimate vendor where you buy, like for businesses who they just want a single vendor, right? They don't want to necessarily buy from a bunch of different companies. But I do think that the cultural element of this is critical. Like Jim Whitehurst has been transformative at two companies now from a cultural perspective. And he's written the book, right? The Open Org, about building open cultures. And I think they know that they need that to succeed, to move forward. If they don't, if they can't unseat that, then I think they're going to struggle. What's interesting to me is the only way that can succeed is if Whitehurst is CEO.
Yeah, but I haven't heard.
And that's not
anyone
on the cards.
As far as I can tell, it's
on not
the
formally
cards
on the cards.
Because I agree, it's not formally on the cards, but everyone alive thinks it's going to happen.
Well, they may do, but I mean, what's her name again? I forget her name.
Rometty.
She said, quote, "I'm still young and I'm not going anywhere."
Yeah, but she's
like,
wrong.
Here is
a tenor which says she's wrong within the next 2 years.
Well, in many ways, it doesn't matter, right? It's what the board thinks. Right.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I would, if I was her, I'd be a bit nervous about this, unless she's planning
on... Well, no, I think that she followed up on that whole IBM 2015 thing, I think, well after everyone, except for maybe her, knew that it wasn't going to happen. And right. I'm guessing this is a way for her on the way out to say, this is my legacy, I changed IBM. It wasn't, it might not have been me that followed through and did it, but I was the thing that started the change.
Right. Yes.
And I can't think of a better person to hand that legacy onto than Jim Whitehurst.
No, I agree.
I mean, I've already shared my admiration for him as a leader multiple times on Bad Voltage. I think he's remarkable. And it is such a logical career step for him to go there. The only other place I could think of him going would be Oracle, where he could have a huge impact. But IBM obviously doesn't have the personality baggage that Oracle's got without Larry Ellison. So.
So it's going to be interesting in a lot of ways. I think, obviously, they're not going to... IBM strategy here is not going to be straight public cloud. It can't be, because they just have too many... The three big competitors, are too much. So what they're going to do is like a hybrid where we understand the enterprises, but we also will run on all of the clouds kind of thing. So I think while they're happy to take, the cash generation machine that is the RHEL subscription business, I think the real price for them here is probably OpenShift. Going to be interesting to see how they roll that out. The other interesting thing for me here, and we haven't touched on how this impacts the broader open source community, is I don't think the board had a choice here. Once IBM gave you a 60% premium on an already pretty frothy stock, I really don't think saying no was an option without a lawsuit. I think if you say no, if you're the board and you're Jim and you say no to $34 billion, I don't know how that doesn't end in a lawsuit.
Well, also, who else would acquire Red Hat? I mean,
but let's say they wanted to stay independent, because many, I know this is madness, but many companies do want to stay independent these days because they see how acquisitions go. Even if they wanted to stay independent, I don't think it was an option on the table for them.
Once this offer
was public knowledge, I don't think it was something they could turn down.
You think they'd have got sued into the ground by people who just want the money regardless?
Oh, absolutely.
I think that's plausible. I'll be honest with you, I hadn't thought about it. We've talked quite a bit about how the acquisition of Red Hat will affect IBM and IBM's culture. The other side of that coin is how will being acquired affect Red Hat? I mean, they have explicitly declared that they're going to be a little ring-fenced separate unit and nothing's going to change and so on, and I'm sure it won't for the first year.
Right.
But I saw someone the other day...
18 months to two.
I saw someone, I mean, you mentioned, you know, knowing how acquisitions go. I saw someone the other day mention HP and Compaq, which I hadn't thought about for years, and I thought, ooh, blimey, there's not a good omen to put on a thing, is it? So what do we think? Do we think Red Hat are still going to be the same 3-4 years from now?
I don't think so.
No, nor do I.
I don't believe you pay $34 billion for a company and things remain the same.
And then you just do it, then they just carry on doing what they were doing before.
I
can see it for Microsoft with GitHub. Because Satya has already had a really positive cultural impact on Microsoft, and that's a company that people want to work for again. And GitHub is such a cultural anomaly in many ways that it makes sense to keep it relatively independent. I don't think that's the same.
So your argument is that Microsoft have already largely made the change in Git and purchasing GitHub is as a result of having made that change, whereas right. IBM are buying Red Hat in order to effectuate the change rather than as a result of already having done so.
That's my theory, at least, yeah.
So I take a slightly different view, although I have the same answer. I think it's why they really can't stay separate forever, realistically, is that IBM has a massive portfolio of things to sell, and too many of them directly compete with something from Red Hat. Far too many of them. So I don't foresee a future which they keep selling WebSphere and JBoss or the multiple different Ceph cluster competitors that IBM has. And if you think of almost every Red Hat product, there's a directly competing IBM product.
I would agree with that, but I can't see any reason why you wouldn't throw the IBM products overboard.
The ones that you already have millions and millions and millions of dollars of existing contracts.
So do Red Hat, right?
Okay, sure. And one probably wins, some IBM ones probably win, some Red Hat ones probably win. But what I'm saying is keeping them separate seems fraught.
Yeah, they're gonna have to integrate them in some way.
Yeah, keeping them separate at a product level. I agree with you. Having Red Hat going out there selling JBoss and IBM people in the next office selling WebSphere and saying, don't buy JBoss, buy WebSphere, it's better. It's better, which is what they're doing today, is not going to be sustainable. I agree with that entirely. But I don't necessarily think that the one that would lose would always be the Red Hat thing until Red Hat just becomes a bunch of blokes in IBM suits and red hats selling IBM products.
Oh, no, I definitely don't think that's going to happen. I think if anything here, if this goes the way that it seems like all three of us think it will go and Jim ends up as the CEO, I think the people that will be most likely to leave are longtime IBM execs because they're going to be super resistant to this change. I think a lot of the younger IBMers get it. I think the people that you're going to see leaving in droves will be the hardline open source folks at Red Hat and the execs at IBM.
Yeah, which I think is is absolutely the case. I mean, you're going to get a whole bunch of people saying, well, what do we need all this stupid open source stuff? What everyone should be using out there is Domino. Right?
I want to make one final comment, and then I suggest we move on. But this is, as is always the case when I make a comment, this is the most important comment that we need to think about.
Is it?
If IBM...
By the Lord, Harry. Let me hold on to something here.
If IBM wants to change and to be a more modern company, it's time they change the fucking logo. That logo is the definition of old, boring dot matrix printout, okay? That's what that logo looks like. It looks like a dot matrix printout. So, IBM hat, time to change the logo, okay?
While I understand your theory, don't get me wrong, can you name an example of when a large company has gone through some kind of massive rebranding exercise and spent $40 million on it, and afterwards you've gone, that was money well spent?
No.
Neither can I.
United?
Did they change their logo?
Yeah.
Does anyone care?
They changed their whole brand guidelines. Like everything's changed with United.
Honestly, right? If I whatever money they spent on that and all the brand, all they need to do is just put an extra inch and a half in between chairs, and I'll be happy. I don't care what the logo looks like.
So we are getting long on this topic, but I do have one more kind of question. I'm curious what you both think in that. Red Hat obviously has a long storied history of employing people to basically do nothing but work on straight open source that really doesn't directly impact their bottom line. And they do this for a variety of reasons and have done this for a long time. IBM, definitely known as an accounting company with a tech arm, is typically not amenable to these kind of arrangements, right? Do you think that it's conceivable that let's not even say long-term because long-term is really hard to predict, medium-term, that those kind of arrangements will stay? And do you think that should, like, what should be the stick for the cultural change has happened? Is that a good yardstick, measuring stick for that? Or is there another one that you can think of? I'm curious how you think this is going to impact the broader open source ecosystem, because Red Hat maintains a ton of things.
Yes. I certainly think I would give the existing Red Hat execs and Jim in particular I believe he would have the integrity to go in and say, no, this is a non-negotiable part of the deal, right? We're doing this and we're going to continue. This is what I think is behind a lot of the, we're going to stay as a separate ring-fenced unit. It's not really to protect the salespeople selling JBoss. It's to protect that open source community investment and guidance and shaping and so on. The question is, and certainly if I'd be able to go, you know what, we're not doing that anymore 6 months from now, there'd be riots and all their Red Hat staff would quit. But over the medium term, 3 to 4 years, I can imagine attrition gradually taking things away. And then on someone's list somewhere will be, oh yeah, we need to backfill for a bunch of those positions, but we just don't really have time at the moment. We'll get to it. So there'll be no explicit, we don't do this anymore declaration. It'll just die away over the next 3 or 4 years, I think. And at that point, Red Hat will have been subsumed into the IBM conglomerate. I would like to believe that Jim becomes CEO, and what happens is that culture of contribution, that desire to contribute inside Red Hat, populates the rest of IBM. That would be great, but that feels like an unwarrantedly hopeful thing to aim for to me.
I take the opposite view, which is...
Okay, next segment. I think
that the behind the scenes reasons for doing all of this is, I think IBM wants to transform IBM into Red Hat, but they need it to have the IBM branding, and I think that's why they're doing this. I think they're looking at what Satya is doing with Microsoft. I think they've seen what Oscar Munoz or whatever his name is has been trying to do with United. And I think they know that they have to do something similar with IBM, and that they know for them to succeed, and part of the reason why Red Hat succeeded is because they've invested in the ecosystem, because they have people working on these projects. And I think if they were to throw that away, they'd be crazy.
So you think they're going to go, having gone from just disallowing remote workers to, because Red Hat is substantially remote, now it'll be fine again?
I think it's going to take them time. There's going to be some really hard cultural change. A lot of people are going to leave. There's going to be a lot of pretty expensive severance packages paid, but I think this is the beginning of them transitioning into a Red Hat, and I think that will be good for open source.
I would agree that that's what they want to happen. I just think that they're looking for I can't imagine they've grasped the sheer magnitude of that task. Right, it worries me that maybe they're thinking we'll just sprinkle the Red Hat magic waffle dust on top of it, and then suddenly we become an open company. And then when you go into one of the IBM teams and say, okay, we can open source this, go, oh no, we can't do that. That can't happen. It's not just about saying we want to be like that culturally. They have to make a whole bunch of sacrifices. And I mean, as you say, I think a load of people are going to leave.
I don't think you pay $34 billion for a company like Red Hat and not expect that you're going to do this. This is why I think it's different to Microsoft and GitHub. I think Microsoft is seeing GitHub as, it's not as blunt as this, as lead gen for people getting connected into Azure. I think it's way more intrinsic with this. Is my theory.
I'm prepared to buy. They want, this is what they want at a top level. I'm just not at all sure they can do it. I mean, the thing Jeremy said, IBM is a very, very, very big ship to steer. Yeah, it is.
Right. Hugely. The thing I haven't seen and that I'm curious to see is what will be the role of Jim Whitehurst in this. Because I think the only way in which that can succeed is if Jim is deeply involved in that.
Chief Executive Officer.
Right.
Question: do you think he'd have to be CEO, or could they make him like Chief Cultural Officer and then say you've got the whip hand to change the company how you see fit?
I think the cultural change will come is every CEO, and at least that I remember, I know IBM has been around since long before me, but they've all been folks with sales backgrounds. Every one of them. Jim isn't.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think that's when you know the change has happened, when there's not a salesperson leading the ship, but a tech person. Right.
Yeah. So let's move on. Yep. I'm bored of this topic now. we also had on the list about the acquisition, the GitHub, talking about acquisitions, the GitHub acquisition is now completed.
Yep.
I would like to make a further prediction. You ready for my prediction?
Okay.
I think that Nat Friedman is going to be CEO of Microsoft after Satya.
Ooh.
Okay.
So I think, yeah.
That's a proper prediction. Wow.
I was going to say, I had a guess as to what you were predicting, and that was not it.
Wow.
I think that...
Big nuts, man. When do you think this will happen?
A long time from now, but I think Nat, and this is not based on any information or anything like that. This is complete speculation. But I just think that this is, if I look at Nat's career, his career has progressed steadily. This is a big deal for him going into GitHub. And while I think he's a wonderful guy and is very capable and he's got a lot of potential, I think it's also going to be a really freaking hard job for him to be successful as CEO of GitHub, because there's still a lot of work that needs to be done there. But I think there's a very good likelihood he's going to succeed there, and that will place him in a very strong position to be CEO of Microsoft.
That's
Satya
fair.
Satya is young, and I think his career aspirations will
transcend. Yeah, Satya's not that much older than us, right? He's like late 40s, early 50s?
I think he's early 50s.
Yeah.
And I think he's going to have broader career ambitions or potentially political ambitions from Microsoft. And I think
maybe. It's hard to have broader career ambitions than being CEO of Microsoft. Who's he going to go to?
CEO
IBM?
Campbell Soup. CEO of United Airlines. CEO of, I think there's a million larger organizations than Microsoft.
Not in terms of money or influence or ability to do things. I mean, having more employees, yeah.
Well, let me rephrase that. I think there's a million companies that I think he would get professional satisfaction out of running than Microsoft. All I'm saying is that I think I don't foresee Satya being at Microsoft.
You do realize that Microsoft has the third highest market cap of any company in the US, right?
Well,
Satya's running Apple or Google. So
I'm talking about his professional satisfaction. I think that he will. I don't see him being at Microsoft for another 30, 40 years.
So you think he would view it as a promotion to go to like Johnson & Johnson?
No, I'm not saying that's not what I said at all. I didn't say it was promotion. What I'm saying is
Cross Blackwell and Nadella.
What is interesting to him from a career perspective?
Interesting.
If you succeed, like if you're at the top of the chain of Microsoft and you turn that company around, at some point that's going to become a bit boring, right? And I think people like him, people like Jim Whitehurst, are motivated in turning things around. I think that's what they do.
I imagined him to go and do the Bill Gates Foundation sort of thing.
And maybe that will be it. And all I'm saying is I don't think he'll be at Microsoft for another 30 or 40 years.
So we can really agree on that.
I don't really give, frankly, much of a shit where he goes. All I care about is that my prediction comes true. And I think that Nat Friedman...
I think he will go and run whatever companies that actually makes Nutella. I'm not sure who it is. There was a guy, you know Arm & Hammer, the company that make toothpaste and loads of other things?
Yeah.
There was a Greek shipping guy called Armand, I think he was Greek, called Armand Hammer. A-R-M-A-N-D Hammer. And he bought Arm & Hammer, the company, as far as I can tell, for lols, because it had his name. And then his accountants made him sell it about 10 years later. They were like, why do you own this company? He went, look, there it is. My name is the company. And they're like, not a good enough reason. And then he had to sell it in like 1985 or something.
That reminds me of the, what's his name? The guy who runs the, I forget who it is, the World Food Program or something, and his name is Robin Mahfood.
Really? This happens a lot. It's a very interesting phenomenon to me.
Yeah, Robin Mahfood. and he runs like the global food something. There's some kind of food initiative.
That's excellent.
Robin Mahfood. Yeah, it's perfect.
Wow. So, I mean, this it's clearly a career path being marked out for you here, Mr. Bacon.
I know.
Often Bernard Matthews or whoever it will be.
All right, let's talk about some different news. What have you got?
Let's talk about some different things. Did you see that working around DRM is now okay in the US? Sort of.
What is? Say that again.
You know how there were a whole bunch of sort of DMCA rules and so on and so forth in the US saying that if something was DRM'd, just breaking that DRM was in itself illegal.
Talking
about it, all this kind of thing. It's now okay. If you've got a device that you own You are now allowed, explicitly, legally allowed to work around DRM and so on that device. You're not allowed to make tools and then distribute them so other people can do it. But you aren't, so if people, this is for things like, you know, printer ink. This is not just, you know, people stealing movies. There's things like printer ink cartridges, or what's that coffee thing where you get the little pods and they...
Nespresso.
Yeah.
Nespresso.
So stuff like that where people are saying, no, you have to buy the things from Tesla, which we talked about on the show a couple of shows ago. Insisting right. that you go back to their dealers and using software methods to lock you out of going to third parties, you are now, they now can't do that, or you are at least allowed to try, as I understand it. Jailbreaking and so on and so forth is now allowed.
Huh.
Yeah.
Which interesting.
An interesting change. It's, I'd say, it's not tools, so you can't share how you did this so other people can do it. So it's not that useful, but this is a minor weakening in the hitherto solid wall policy of you can't do any of this stuff. I thought that was interesting.
What precipitated this change?
I don't know. Maybe the open source community got bored of shouting about it all the time, and so people went, oh, maybe we should do that now.
Right, yeah. It was defective by design.
That has, my God, defective by design. I'd forgotten about them.
Wearing a yellow jumpsuit. Change the rules.
I do not know what prompted the change, particularly. They do these.
So it's interesting. A lot of it was lobbying by iFixit. They actually had a lot to do with this.
Oh, really? Oh, I didn't know that. Yeah.
iFixit, the people who fix your broken screens.
They have the videos and they sell the tooling and all that stuff. Yeah.
Teardowns and stuff like that.
Yep.
Wow.
Oh, those people. I was thinking of You Break, I Fix, or whatever those people are. I know you're talking about. Yeah.
I did not know that. That's pretty cool. I mean,
interesting.
If you read the freedoms, they're super weird though. Like you can unlock new phones, but not used ones.
Yeah.
I scanned through it quickly, but.
Yeah, it is. This sort of thing seems completely inconsistent. I mean, obviously, you know, people like us have been kind of, why are there any rules about this stuff at all? It's ridiculous. And it used to be, you can't do any of this, none of it at all. And this this feels like a chink in the armor, at which point it's easier to demonstrate the rules you've done are stupid and inconsistent, which presumably means the chink gets wider.
Yep.
As time goes on, one would hope.
But like game consoles were explicitly
excluded. I don't necessarily agree that any rules around this stuff are ridiculous, by the way.
Okay.
I mean, my views on DRM have changed over the years a little bit because I think we've seen that just the free availability of content, you know, for one small example, basically killed the music industry. Like shoving shit on the internet means that people don't necessarily want to pay for shit anymore, right? So if you want to be able to make money around content, you basically need to have some form of DRM in play. So I've, you know, back when we were doing Logrado, I was like, DRM is terrible, but I've changed my views in some ways. I still think that the way it's applied in certain ways is not good. But anyway.
I think part of the issue there is precisely that if you try and come up, you know, a lot of the original DRM-ish laws were maybe not put in place, but heavily lobbied for by people like the entertainment industry. But then you get printer companies who come along and gone, right, we can now make printer cartridges where you have to buy them from us. They are allowed to lie to you about how much ink you've got, and there is nothing you can do about it. And even attempting to prove that we've done that is in itself illegal. So a whole bunch of people kind of jumped on the back of those laws. And I don't know if there's a way of going, you're allowed to use it because there are good reasons and you aren't because you aren't, you know?
Right. Yeah.
So, I mean, I can see your point. I think we've all become a bit less fire breathing about this in the last 10 years.
This sounds like a segment in a future show.
It does, actually. Stick a pin in it and we'll come back to it. Is it a good idea? Yes or
it
no?
It does. Although I agree. It sounds like a segment. I just, oh God. I think I have PTSD from so many uninteresting conversations about DRM. I've just grown to just not care about it. Like there's just certain topics that are important. I just don't want to talk about anymore. like
so we'll politics. we'll do a whole show where we talk about like circumventing technical protection measures and which license you should choose for your open source project. And we'll record this whole thing and then we'll throw it into a volcano and never release it.
Why don't we, I have an idea for a series. Why don't we do a show, why don't we do for the next three shows where we'll have a segment where, let's say the next show is about Stuart, where Jeremy and I will pick the topic that Stuart is most uninterested in and we will discuss that. And then we'll do it for each of us. I think that would be fun.
That would be fine. Sure. On a completely unconnected note, I'm not around in the next show. I'm on holiday.
All right.
Don't know when the next show is. Don't know where I'm going. Off to skyscanner.net to find somewhere cheap. Right, next piece of news.
What's next, Jeremy? Give us some sugar.
So did you both see the new Google Home Hub? Jano, I suspect you already own three of these.
I do not own three of these. Just cheeky sod.
Is hilariously and surprisingly for them, because their previous devices have seemed pretty secure, but unsecure. You can actually, with a curl command, with no authentication, no token, no anything, completely reboot it, get a ton of information out of it. And the API endpoint, by the way, is Eureka_info, which amused me for some reason.
Yeah.
But yeah, you can pretty much do whatever you want with these with absolutely no authentication, with nothing but curl.
I was genuinely surprised you just got an open HTTP API. I mean, we talked, when we talked about Google Plus, we talked about how Google used to be quite good at APIs, and Google Plus bizarrely didn't have one. But something else didn't have one is all their hardware devices, right? So Chromecasts, for example, there is obviously a way that applications and so on talk to them and say, play this YouTube video, Chromecast, but Google will not document how it works. The original first release Chromecast, they did. It was a thing called Dial. And then they went, no, we're taking that away now. And so you have to use their authorized app, which uses secret APIs to do all the talking. And the hardware devices in general have been very much like that. So you can't talk to your Google Home the way you want and poke it and so on, but obviously people are. The thing which surprised me about this is I assumed that these things were basically a Google Home with a screen glued on the front.
Right,
but
so
then, but then why would it change? I mean, on a completely separate note, I don't understand why people keep pushing these with screens on the front, the Amazon Show and so on. I don't care. But
what's more interesting about this one too, just not to interrupt, but just to dovetail on that, is the show I kind of get, I think it's aimed at grandparents that want to talk to their grandkids. So it has a screen and a microphone and everything. This doesn't even have a camera, so it can't be used for video calls.
Yeah, it's just a tablet.
So anyways.
I don't know why this thing exists.
I think it's designed as a screen in your kitchen. It's designed for people looking at... I think, you know, they market it as, you know, people don't want to be fumbling with their phones or in the kitchen or whatever. I get why they're doing this. I don't know how useful it is. But by the way, this is our generation's, or, well, the newer generation's WinNuke, isn't it? Right?
Yeah.
You remember WinNuke?
Yeah.
So for listeners who are not 500 years old...
The ping of death.
WinNuke was the ping of death. It was basically, essentially a remote denial of service attack that affected a bunch of versions of Windows. And what it would do is it was basically you'd run this thing. Often people would run this on IRC, and then it would lock up someone's machine and display a blue screen of death. So conceivably, you could have people just basically blasting out, you know, these reboot commands.
Well, I mean, you've got to be on the same network as it, right? So right. I'd have to be on your Wi-Fi. But there is nothing stopping me walking into your house on your Wi-Fi and then just killing all of your Google Home hubs.
Or just driving by, scanning open Wi-Fi networks.
I'm, as Jeremy says, I'm genuinely surprised that Google have done this. I mean, I can see how they might go, okay, there is an API to talk to this thing, here's the documentation. But historically, they've either gone, yeah, this is an API you're allowed to call, or this is an API that you're not allowed to call, and therefore we're going to go out of our way to make it difficult for you to do so.
Right. Not just pass the word now to the reboot endpoint, which is what this is.
That's literally it. It's nuts. You just post the word now or params now.
Params now.
It's been a tough week for Google.
Ooh, it has.
Did, Did you see the that right now there's actually as we record this, there is a walkout happening at Google.
Yeah.
Some global protests. Last week there was a news story went live that Andy Rubin, who is seen by many as basically the forefather of Android. Was basically a story came out, I think it was in the New York Times about some sexual misconduct that occurred. Some bondage was found, videos were found on his work computer and various other things that were occurring. And then it sounds like basically he was paid off by Google and they tried to sweep this under the rug. And Google employees are not unsurprisingly a bit miffed about this. And
just
They've staged walkouts across the world. And
be clear, that was what kind of prompted this, but that's not what they're walking out about, right? What they've said they're doing this for. They've got five demands, right? An end to forced arbitration in cases of harassment and discrimination, a commitment to end pay and opportunity inequity, publicly disclosed sexual harassment transparency report, a globally inclusive process for reporting sexual misconduct safely and anonymously, and make the chief diversity officer answer directly to the CEO. So the Rubin thing is, I think they would say this is one example of the kind of thing they're talking about, and it's a very high-profile example, but what they're looking for is cultural change inside Google.
Well, wasn't that the straw that broke the camel's back? Demands have kind of, like, shaken out of that?
I don't know whether people wanted this stuff before and now they've got something to hang the demand on, or whether people were kind of, I'm really upset about this. What are you upset about? It can't just be Andy Rubin. No, I'm upset about these things. And then that became a manifesto.
Well, there was another guy from Google X as well that is even more recent.
Yes, Richard DeVol. Yes, it was the New York Times reported Rubin, Richard DeVol, who was at Google X.
I was going to say it's not Astro Teller, is it? That guy seems cool. So
a whole bunch of people. I mean, all over the place. In cities all over the world.
Yep.
Singapore and Dublin and London and Zurich and...
Right. I did think it was cool that Google CEO said, you know, we support everybody who's going to be doing the walkout, you know, and, you know, I thought that was important.
Sundar Pichai, yeah.
Yeah. So, this is difficult.
It is.
Yeah.
I mean, I think some of these demands are a little bit ridiculous that they don't already exist. Like a commitment to end pay inequality, I don't know why that doesn't already exist.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I agree. I also do think that the chief diversity officer should report into the CEO.
That seems reasonable.
That role, I think, is largely ineffective unless it's at a senior level. You needed to be able to... policy needs to be able to transcend across multiple different departments, right?
And the policy actually has to have teeth, or else it's kind of useless.
Right. Yeah. Exactly.
Otherwise, it's a bunch of people writing recommendations in the room that never get read, or people go, "Oh yeah, we'll do that," and then just don't do it.
Yeah.
So
that one surprised me because I just, without ever having checked, I admit, I just sort of assumed they did. I don't understand how you can be chief anything officer and not report to the CEO. Otherwise, you're not the bloody chief, are you?
it's not an illogical argument, right there.
You know,
you know what really struck me in this story as well, and this is not meant to, by any stretch of the imagination, belittle the real story that's occurring here. Of you know, this issues of sexual misconduct and how that's managed and how that's treated fairly, all the rest of it. What really struck me is who the hell has bondage videos in their work computer? Like, why?
Yeah, I didn't hear that part before just now, actually. So.
Why would you do that? Look, I work from home. It's different when you work from home, okay? But going to an office...
I haven't got any bondage videos on this computer either.
I mean, haven't got any bondage computers.
I suppose that's what he digs, then fine, you know, it's up to him. But yeah, on your work computer, yes, I don't understand that.
Why would you have, it seems very simple to me. Don't look porn up on your work computer. Like, that's step number one. Step number two is don't download it onto your work computer.
This does seem... Yeah.
It just seems like for someone so smart, for someone so accomplished, it seems like such a... I mean, from what I understand, there was nothing, you know, from what I understand, there was nothing in terms of the content that was found on the computer. It's nothing like illegal or anything like that. But like, I just, that was the thing that really, one element that really got me on this. So anyway.
Yeah.
Anyway, so obviously, you know, the Bad Voltage team sympathizes with all this shit getting straightened out at Google. It needs to happen. You know, so hopefully we'll see positive motions moving forward.
And I do think it's interesting that we're in... This is going to sound a bit stupid, but...
No.
People doing this sort of, you know, we're doing a big global walkout. People sort of gradually rediscovering that collective action works, you know? And you don't want to sound like some 1970s trade union leader sitting about going, see, I told you so, but... That's kind of, we seem to be rediscovering why things like unions got created in the first place before that path went slightly wrong in various ways. And I think it's interesting.
The thing is as well, though, is what I like here is to me, like people, like we've talked multiple times in the show previously about the value of civil unrest, but in a way like legal civil unrest, right? And the value of protest. But also, protest is kind of pointless in some ways unless there's a clearly understood purpose for it, I think. And what I like about this is they've got those five requirements. So it's like it means that you're going out and you're protesting, but there's something that you're protesting about. To me, just standing outside of a building and banging a drum with a stick and holding a sign up, yes, if there's enough people do that, you can make a point and that can trigger some conversations that can then result in some change. But it's way more effective, I think, when you've got a specific set of requirements or demands that you're putting forward.
Yes.
So I think the way in which they're this doesn't surprise me. I mean, these are smart people who work at Google. And so I think the way they've done this makes a lot of sense.
There was some years ago, 10, 12 years ago probably, the UK government tried to bring in a law called SOCPA, S-O-C-P-A, which was about banning protests inside London unless you applied for a permit beforehand, right? So me and Bill...
Was there a protest to that?
There was, in fact, a protest about it. me and Bill and Ginny and Mark Thomas, the comedian, and about, you know, a couple of thousand other people went down to protest. But because it was being partially run by Mark Thomas, who's a comedian, very politically active comedian, but still a comedian, half the job was to take the piss out of how stupid this law was. But one of the things that stuck in my mind, and I've still got a picture of it somewhere, is Bill standing there with a sign on, I think, Westminster Bridge, and the sign said, "Down with this sort of thing." And... while that was a piss take, I completely agree with your point that there's a whole bunch of people like, we're protesting. And you're like, what are you protesting about? It's like, just things that are wrong. This is wrong and it should be fixed. Like, yeah, okay, I get that. But then what you've done is you've given people no actions. And if your answer is we will sweep away you and everything you stand for, then, yeah, no one's really going to listen to your protest, no matter how true it is.
Bill is clearly a fan of Father Ted.
Yes. And so, comedy genius.
Also, Mark Thomas, I haven't thought about him for a while. Most Americans probably won't have heard of him.
No.
But
no.
He was... I have the same view of him as I do of Zach de la Rocha from Rage Against the Machine, which is a great band, amusing comedian, but stop ranting, okay? Like, oh, we get it. Okay. So we get it. But he was funny. He was funny. He seems to have vanished into obscurity as well, from what I can tell.
I believe he's still doing stuff, but I'm not paying a lot of attention. Anyway.
What else do we have?
Next thing.
Look through the list. Let's look through the list. Go
on, then.
I have a tiny one. I don't think this will take very long. I stumbled on this. Apparently, it's a revolutionary health smartwatch. Did you guys have a look at the link that I put into this?
Yes.
Show notes about the X Medicus. This is the Kickstarter campaign. I'll stick a link in the show notes.
Yeah.
But, Apparently it's pretty revolutionary. It's got integrated PPG, ECG, PWTT. PWTT is apparently blood pressure. ECG is heart.
Mm-hmm.
PPG, is that heart as well? I can't remember what that is.
NFI.
and 512 hertz real medical raw data. I'm not entirely sure what 512 hertz real medical raw data actually is.
I don't know what that is either, but whatever that medical raw data is, you get it 512 times a second. So that's fantastic.
But go and look at the Kickstarter campaign for this, because it looks kind of, it claims to basically do more, measure more things. It claims to measure more things than you know, the Apple Watch and whatever else.
While looking exactly like a 10-year-old pebble.
Yes. It is not all that attractive. It looks quite cheap. The descriptions of it are not text. They are a big picture of some text, which annoyed me as the first thing.
That was the first thing that annoyed me. It's like, I appreciate how you've constructed this.
Yeah, there are other things to get annoyed about. And it says the description of it, two finest Italian leather replaceable watch straps. All of the words have capital letters, right? Which makes it look like one of those things where, you know, some advert on Amazon from some company in China who are flogging you a thing which is almost but not quite a Rolex for $9. I am not convinced by this device at all. I mean, is it even, you know about this, Jezza? Is it even plausible, all the stuff they're claiming to measure?
I mean, if you look at the comparison with the Apple Watch Series 4, it basically does all the same things in one. It does VO2 Max, the Garmin I have does VO2 Max as well. So, it's a plausible number of things given what the new Garmin's do and what the Apple Watch does. It's just... It's definitely an interesting Kickstarter page. I'll give it that. The fact that everything is an image is alarming.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's just...
It's also probably the longest Kickstarter page I've ever seen.
Yeah, the whole thing just made me cross, to be honest with you.
I like also the random... it's about maybe halfway down the page, just a picture of a bunch of people drinking.
Oh, I didn't
see pictures
that.
Of the watch in there, from what I can tell.
Hang on,
it's just people sat in a lounge, one guy with a whiskey... and a checkout system that looks like it's 10 years old.
Maybe the whiskey comes with the watch. I'd be fully in favor of a smartwatch that did that. You put, oh yeah, look, here it is. Here's a picture of just some people in a hotel bar or something.
Right.
I would like to encourage everyone who's listening to this, when you are safely in front of a computer, to go and watch the Kickstarter video on the Kickstarter campaign. It is quite funny, and it reminds me of, do you remember that bullshit thing that Erica bought, the Heelby Gobi or whatever it was called? Do you remember that thing that we talked about in the show one time? What was it called? The something Gobi. It was like a smartwatch type thing that apparently will track the glucose content in your blood, and it was, she showed me this campaign. She's like, I've invested in two of these things. And this looked like an ad that like Borat would put on. It was terrible. This reminded me of that. So I'd encourage you to go and watch the Kickstarter, and then one of you to go and invest in it so you can tell us what it's like.
I have a blast from the past for you. Do you remember the Arubics?
The Arubics?
Yeah.
Whatever happened to that?
That thing that wrapped on your arm, yep. The screen.
Yep, which we said did not and would not exist.
Their CEO periodically sends me a message.
Really? Is it almost ready to release now?
We took a shit on that from quite a considerable height.
We did.
I
can't remember whether that or the Mars One project got the biggest panning from us, but it's one of those two.
Mars One, yeah. By the way, have you seen the Blocks Box?
No.
No.
You two are in front of a computer. Type in the word block, BLOXVOX.
Blocks Vox, okay. You meant to put this sort of thing in the show notes. I know. Customized for your company, Blocks Vox is now accepting large custom orders. It's
okay.
What is it?
Look at it.
It's a blob with headphones and an Adobe logo on, apparently.
You can talk in an office without interrupting other people.
It's a mask that you strap on the front of your head.
I've just seen a GIF of it.
Your voice is blocked from people nearby, but perfectly audible to the person you're calling.
Also,
it's both private, inefficient, and worry-free.
If what you want to do is sit about in your office and look like Bane from The Dark Knight Returns, then yeah, absolutely. I believe I'll be buying none of these devices.
I saw this. I just could not stop laughing. And then I saw that Unbox Therapy did a review of the Bloxbox. And let me just say, it was an unkind review.
It cost $50.
Can you imagine sitting in an office and saying, hang on, I got to hop on a conference call and sticking that thing
I just have to don my Bloxbox. For people who haven't had a chance to go and look at it yet, as far as I can tell, it's literally just a plastic cup such as one might wear when playing cricket.
Yes.
Which you strap to the front of your head and then put your microphone from your, from the earphones on your phone, you put your microphone inside it. So you speak into this weird foam box, which cost you $50, by the way.
Now, I don't want to disappoint the two of you, but if you actually click through to the Kickstarter, funding unsuccessful. They only got $4,533 out of $25,000 goal. Yeah. But 49 people did back this.
You know what I love about it, though? One person who backed the... I think we should rename it to the Bollocks Box, okay?
Bollocks Box, yeah.
One person who backed the Bollocks Box backed the $875 or more, which is a 25-pack. Can you imagine running an office and showing up with 25 of these things and saying, surprise, everyone!
Okay, people. This is going to create... we need you to wear this.
It is absolutely ridiculous.
18 people have backed the Ridicular Watch or whatever it's called. So, yes. Anyway. So, yeah. I am not convinced by the thing. In our show notes, right, Jono's written, apparently Revolutionary Health Smartwatch and a bunch of descriptions, and then just written, looks fishy to me, which sounds like a very good description of it, in my opinion.
Do we, I think we have about...
Do you have any more news?
Let's do one more.
One thing I was going to mention, we've talked before about System 76 setting up their own manufacturing facility in the US and so on
and
so forth.
We love our friends at System 76.
They wrote quite an interesting post about it. I mean, I'm not going to go through it now. We'll link to it in the show notes. But they've also released shots of their new Thelio desktop, which has got a wooden or at least partially wooden case. And it looks very pretty. And every time they make one, they plant a tree to replace the wood, which I thought was pretty cool.
I didn't know that. That is cool.
Yeah.
Ian
mentioned it on our on the Bad Voltage Slack channel. And I went, that is a good fact. I like that. And it does actually look quite pretty. I mean, you know how I feel about attractive looking computer cases. And this one is actually nice, in my opinion. It's a shame I've already got a nice computer case. But if one of these arrived in the post, that would be fine.
Yeah, but you buy that nice computer case like 5 years ago?
Yeah, but the whole point of buying a desktop machine is I don't have to replace the whole computer when I want to upgrade it, right? That is entirely the point.
That's a good point. It's a good point.
I didn't know you had any computer that Jono didn't give you, so that's news to me.
Boom goes the dynamite.
We have less of that from you, Garcia.
I think we should have more of that from you, Garcia.
But yeah, I just thought that was nice, they've been doing this for quite a while now, and it's good to see it getting increasingly close to arriving and them doing more stuff. So well played, System 76.
Yeah,
very cool.
I don't want to turn this into a System 76 love fest, but they're a company that just continually impresses me. Like, and they're playing in a pretty hard space, right? Like hardware, they've had to basically create hardware that's different and interesting, knowing that they have a very limited set of component suppliers that they can source from. Then this must be an enormous change for them. The fact that they can, manufacture some of this stuff. It's pretty cool. So
yeah,
yep.
You know, good work, System 76.
One of the nice things about it, their plan. I mean, they talk in this long blog post about how, you know, they've said words like open hardware, but that doesn't necessarily mean that everything's open right the way down to how the chips are designed and so on, and firmware in the chips and so on. That all belongs to Intel, and they can't fix that. But things like the designs for the laptop bodies and so on are going to be open. So right. People can take them and have them printed themselves somewhere if they want to, or change how things work and so on. And they really do seem to have a commendable commitment to openness in this hardware manufacturing thing, which I like.
Yeah. I think Carl gets it.
I do. The only criticism I have of System 76, and I've said this before, is they need to change that damn Popos logo. That's the only thing. That's the only thing that I don't like.
That logo does really grind your gears.
It does. This has been very much about logos in this show. So.
It has. In fact, I'm going to make a note of that, so I call it something to do with logos. As you said, the name up.
That gets us to 1 hour. Do we want to do one more, or do we want to discuss Common Clause and the Mongo change, or is that too much to?
I think that would be a bit too meaty.
I feel like where that goes is that show where we're going to talk about the GPL and like circumventing technical protection mechanisms and stuff.
Why don't we do a show on circumventing technology, and then we can talk about, because Common Clause is kind of that, right? in an unfavorable way of looking at it.
From a kind of abstract point of view, yes, it is.
Yeah.
No, we're not going to do that. All right.
I think we're done, what I think.
Are either of you two speaking anywhere in the next couple of weeks?
Thankfully not.
No,
not the
done
next
now.
Couple weeks, no.
Been too much freaking travel.
And you had to fly back from Edinburgh. I mean, so did I, but it took me like 45 minutes, which was nice.
I was going to say, my 7 hours doesn't seem so bad when you're over in New York. It's like you're almost a little over halfway only.
Yeah.
but it was a fun time while we were there.
We had a great time. We had a lot of fun.
Oh, Baconio. Have you tried flying the drone that you got from the IBM Cloud people? Since we had a go at IBM Cloud earlier, we should mention, they had a stand at Open Source Summit in Edinburgh, and you were supposed to go through this whole procedure of teaching it how to recognize photos and stuff, but IBM Cloud kept falling over. So the bloke went, okay, it doesn't work, never mind, and then gave us a prize anyway, which was a drone. Yes. And I've tried flying it, but it turns out I'm not very good at flying drones. So they gave us two spare little propeller things to go on it for when you smack it into a wall and one of them falls off and then you can't find it. And I've used them both already.
Didn't you, Mr. Bacon, crash an actual high-quality drone shortly after getting it?
Let's not dwell on the past. Yes. I would say that your experience there, Ack, with the little mini IBM freebie drone was partially the fact that you can't fly a drone, and partially because that drone can't fly in a straight line as well.
So it's not just me then. I mean, I must confess, my part of the problem is because I've not really done a lot of drone flying before. My instinctive reaction when something is going wrong is to do what you do in a car, which is stamp on the brakes. Right?
Right.
So your drone's flying, you think, oh no, it might brush against a wall. So I immediately do what my brain thinks is step on the brakes, which is pull the spinning speed down to nothing, at which point obviously it drops out of the sky like a rock, because that's what it is. which is why it keeps smacking into the floor and I keep losing the propellers when they fall off.
Yeah. No, I mean, from what I can tell, that drone is basically on a suicide mission, because it just... You push the little thing up by just a fraction, and then it just immediately flies into a wall, or immediately flies into a couch or somewhere. I also discovered that you have to put the different colored propellers. They've got to match the side with the lights.
Yes,
on.
They do.
Otherwise, it just doesn't go anywhere. So, ours is already destroyed. Jack was thrilled when I brought it back for him, because it's like, oh, wow, cool, a drone. And then reality set in. But thank you, IBM.
Yes, no, thank you very much. That was cool.
It was a cool conference giveaway, and also the guys on the IBM stand were really nice and very friendly.
Yeah, so, they were, actually.
Yeah, they were very friendly indeed. And their technology did actually look really cool. So We just didn't get a chance to play it because there was some networking issues or something happening at the show. But
yes,
Open Source Summit Europe was fun. So
it was. One other thing I should mention, you two, what is the name of Microsoft's cloud service?
Azure.
Jeremy?
Yeah.
This is not Azure. A trick question.
Azure.
I think it is a trick question.
No, it isn't, right? I think, yes, that's the name of it, but I think it's supposed to be pronounced Azure.
Yeah, right? It's Azure. Yeah.
So a bunch of people did used to say Azure, and now I notice very few people say it, and everyone says Azure. So
yes, but what I think is interesting is on the Microsoft stand at Open Source Summit, they had a big sign, and it said, Explore Azure. And if that was Explore Azure, then it wouldn't rhyme. And so clearly they've picked this little slogan because it rhymes. So it's meant to be Azure. This is actual proof, in my opinion.
You seem very excited about this.
Well, I spent ages not understanding what people were talking about. Because
if I remember correctly, you might have tweeted out about this as well.
I did. I'm just further reinforcing the point. Especially because I mentioned it to Steve Wally, who works for Microsoft, who didn't believe me. I'm like, it's there in a sign on your own stand.
Just because it may rhyme doesn't mean that that was the point of them doing that.
It would seem weird to me to pick a rhyming slogan that doesn't rhyme. Do you not think?
I'm not saying it was a rhyming slogan is my point.
So I think the color is pronounced like you said, Eck. When Rasinovich talks about it on stage, he says Azure.
Yeah, but
I'm going to go with the CEO of the division as opposed
I am ramblings full board death of the author on this. Doesn't matter what he thinks.
I agree. Doesn't matter what the guy in charge of Azure thinks. What matters more is Ginger Guy in Birmingham. Okay.
What matters more is that its name is Azure. Anyway.
On that bombshell, I think we should peace out. Thank you, everybody, for listening. It's always a pleasure. As usual, go to community.badvoltage.org, leave your thoughts, or join the Slack channel. We always love to hear what you think. And we'll be back at some point in the next couple of weeks. I'm going to be in England when we're next due to record this. So we're going to have to do some schedule shuffling.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, in fact, I'm going to be going over to see Mr. Langridge. So, but we'll figure something out. But yes,
I will make sure getting extra stocks of Horlicks and go to bed at 9 o'clock in the evening. That's what's going to happen that day.
Make sure you've got a Bible in next to my bed. All right,
later,
I'm
going to
click stop now.
Bye, everyone.